I know that it's cliche to be into F1 right now.
A little bit. If anything, I'd say you're a little bit behind the curve.
They don't say that in F1.
Do they not?
I don't know.
I wouldn't know. I'm not on that bandwagon.
Like, I feel like a lot of people are really into F1 right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be, you know, an F1 person just talking about my race cars, my Verstappens or whatever. But I thought that I was going to watch all the F1 races this year.
And how's that going so far? Because it has started, right?
Yeah, I've watched two races. Oh. And there's another one coming up.
Pretty good. So yeah. You're on the right track?
Stop it. Anyway, so YouTube is suggesting F1 videos to me.
Obviously. Did you see that one with the Red Bull FPV drone?
That video was nuts.
That was a pretty cool video.
It's absolutely nuts. If we can get to a point where they can actually do like live tracking FPV
man.
During the races.
That'd be cool.
It would be sick. It was very, very cool. There's this guy named Kim Illman. I don't know if that's his real name.
It's a pretty cool name.
Yeah. Oh, man, that guy's so ill. Ill man. Anyways, he's a photographer. He does photography stuff, as one might expect. And I watched this video that he did where he was talking about like how he shoots F1 races and what camera he uses and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whatever. It was interesting. I liked hearing him. Obviously, he uses like a twin harness. He's got double R3s, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
He uses a Stream Deck to help him deliver his photos.
Oh, and that's the little USB thing that sits on your desk and has buttons on it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a glorified macro keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And for these races, they have like press centers. And so they give you like a little desk where you can charge all your gear and like set up your laptop and that sort of thing. And so he brings the Stream Deck thing with him. And he has a bunch of like shortcut stuff set up so that whenever he brings in the photos, he can quickly tag them by car company, by race car driver, and all this other information, and like export things with presets and blah, 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 to like move his workflow along really, really quickly for all the repetitive stuff that he has to do whenever he processes his photos.
I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
I like that.
Super cool. Saves him a ton of time.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a Stream Deck for like 3 years.
Yeah.
How come you're not as cool as this guy?
I need to get on that level. I mean, the real answer to that question is that I've had it hooked up to my work computer because I use it to mute my mic for video calls.
Sure.
And stuff like that. And because I have it hooked up to my work computer, it's kind of inconvenient to hook up to my Mac. And so I can't really use it for personal stuff, but maybe I should. It's a good idea.
Maybe you should. Just think of all the possibilities.
Yeah.
Think of all those repetitive tasks you're doing.
Mm.
You probably could cut down by like 30 minutes on your podcast editing if you use the Stream Deck.
I don't know about that at this point, but maybe.
I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah. It's an interesting idea, you know, or like us going through footage and Resolve kind of makes
sure.
You wonder if maybe there's something interesting there with, you know, I don't know, like how, you know, the Resolve has those special keyboards that let you, you know, jog through footage and things like that. And it's kind of a similar idea.
Stuff like this always reminds me that I love optimizing. And when I'm not optimizing to my full potential, I think about how I'm just really letting myself down and everybody else down. And I think that you need to get on Kim's level.
Welcome back to the Camera Gear Podcast. I'm Daniel.
And I'm Lucas.
And we're here today to talk about the gear, software, and techniques we use to shoot photos and video.
Daniel, I need you to tell everybody about how important we are as a podcast and how much of an influence we have on the rest of the internet.
I mean, I would say that I wasn't fully aware of the scope of our influence until this past week.
I mean, we've mentioned it before that we're trendsetters.
That's true. That's true. We have mentioned that. But last week on this show, we talked about Nikon Coolpix.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, what are the chances that we would start talking about the Nikon Coolpix on this podcast? I feel like, you know.
Very, very low.
Yeah. I mean, just.
Well, no, wait. Very, very high. No, wait.
I mean, it's just a very specific thing for us to have brought up in that show.
Sure.
And the day that show came out.
Yeah. It came out like, what, 5 a.m.?
Yeah, it came out 5 a.m. By that afternoon, Petapixel had posted an article saying that Google searches for the Nikon Coolpix are up 100%.
Oh boy.
And I'm sure that these two events are completely correlated.
Yeah. Correlation versus causation.
Yeah.
This is absolutely we caused that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
So you're welcome, internet. Now everybody knows about the cool pics because of this podcast.
I'm trying to figure out if it's a problem or not. I mean, we've talked at length about the X100V effect and X106 and who those cameras are for and the whole like old versus new market and using all these old digital cameras and all that trend and that sort of thing.
Right.
Coolpix is back now. And I'm wondering, what are the teens going to discover next? Because, I mean, they're starting to get into it. I mean, sure, they know that film cameras exist and maybe they're going to figure that out eventually. It's probably just too hard. Film is just horrible. No one should shoot film, except for me, I guess. But I mean, there's the Coolpix. What are they going to find next? Like, what are they missing?
They're just digging through the bargain bin of old cameras.
Yeah, I mean, it's just stuff out. Somebody's finding these at like some TikTokers find them at Goodwill. I mean, first they listen to this podcast, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
Which is why I have more suggestions, which we'll get into in a second.
All right.
I'm just wondering, like, where are they finding these cameras? Mm-hmm. Are they just searching for old digital cameras and like finding the one that looks cool, or I don't know, what are they doing?
We should ask that person we know who was running around the Coolpix. We should ask like how that came about.
That's a very good question. We should ask that person why that camera, how did they land on it, and where was it suggested?
Yep. I think that's some research we should undertake. Come back in a future episode.
I'm just saying we need to get ahead of this curve.
You're probably right.
I mean, the Coolpix thing was us, like 100% that was us, but there's probably going to be something else.
Mm-hmm.
We got to get ahead of it.
Yeah. Yeah. We got to make that content so that all those teens can listen to Camera Gear podcast and, you know, figure out what other cameras to get.
Exactly.
Here we are.
Follow us on TikTok.
Yes. TikTok that we do not have.
They don't need to know that.
Maybe we can start one right as it gets banned.
Perfect. That is coming up, isn't it? When are they? Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't care. Okay. We've talked a little bit about power shots. You mentioned it last week, and I was like, psh, power shots, whatever. But I mean, Canon's been making power shots for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to point out the Canon Power Shot N.
Sounds fast.
It's basically a Coolpix, except it's cooler because it's not rectangular. It's more square than rectangular.
Huh.
It's got a flippy screen, but the screen flips up only 90 degrees. It doesn't go all the way around.
No, problem. That doesn't count.
But it's got like a little 16 times zoom on it. And it's like a 1/2.3 sensor. But it's just like super tiny. It's square shaped and it makes it fun.
Yeah. Now, does the Coolpix have a zoom?
Yeah, you can get Coolpixes with a zoom. Okay. It just depends on which Coolpix you're getting.
I see.
It's a whole line of cameras. There's some with flippy screens, or some that do video, some that don't.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends on what you're looking for.
I see.
Diving into the Coolpix world, it's like a whole other thing.
Yeah, you kind of have a 1,000-yard stare talking about that, which makes me think there's a lot of Coolpixes out there.
Yes. Okay. I'm just saying, if the teens find the Canon PowerShot N, it's going to be the next Coolpix. I'm telling you. It's not. I wish I had a bigger sensor. But it's kind of fun, and you can get it in like white,
yeah,
or other colors.
Looks like it's at 12 megapixels.
Yeah, a little 12 megapixels.
That's enough. You know, that's the same number of megapixels as the A7S III.
Exactly. This is basically an A7S III.
Pretty much.
Okay, I got another one for you.
Okay.
This one is a Coolpix, and that's the Nikon Coolpix A. And this thing, I don't know why it's not as popular as a Ricoh GR3.
Well, what year did it come out?
2013.
Okay, that's not that old.
Not that old.
Okay.
It's basically a Ricoh GR3. It has a 16 megapixel APS-C sensor. So that's full Nikon DX.
Yeah, that's respectable.
Yeah, it has like decent ISO performance up to like 6400.
Mm-hmm.
It has extendable like two stops above that, but you know, 100 to 6400, you know, kind of, this is a 16 megapixel APS-C sensor from 2013.
Yeah.
But like very similar to the Ricoh that came out at the same time. Maybe some people think it's the same sensor. Who knows? Has an 18.5 millimeter F2 lens on it. Fixed lens.
Good. Yeah.
And it's like $350 to $600.
I mean, I almost think that at that point, the name Coolpix is actually hurting that camera.
I think that this, we talked about this last week, I think. or was it before? Well, we've talked about it before, where the like the X100 V X106 is top end, and it's like this is premium,
right?
Versus, and you can like take premium and like work it backwards, like make cheaper version, or you can take your entry like point and shoot camera and then make it fancy,
right?
And this was sold in 2013 as a premium compact that was supposed to be competitive with the, let's say, the X100V, and then what was the other one that was out at that time? There was the 100D or something from Panasonic, and then the Sony RX1.
Okay,
that's what that was the main competitor for this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was probably $1,000 whenever it came out, but it is weird that it's like Coolpix up. I think if a different for a name, maybe would have made it more popular. Yeah. But also, maybe that's why people aren't looking at this thing. They just think it's like a point and shoot camera with a 1/2-inch sensor, and it's sitting over here with an APS-C side sensor.
Yeah, I mean, probably. Like, if I saw the name Coolpix, I would not assume that it had this feature set. So,
and it's almost exactly the same size as a GR3, which, as you know, pretty small camera.
Yeah, that is small. Now, how much does this thing cost?
Like I said, it's like $350 to $600.
Oh, okay.
Used.
Okay. It's not bad.
Yeah. Not
maybe you
bad.
Should get one of those. You could be a Nikon shooter.
I could. I would have to cross shop it against something that is similarly priced, which is an EOS M200.
Now see, I saw this on the show notes, and my immediate thought was, oh, Lucas found a film camera. So is this film or is this a same type of market?
Similar market, digital camera,
okay.
Interchangeable lens camera. This is an M mount, EFM mount,
mm-hmm.
Canon camera from like whatever, 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Yeah.
It's APS-C, but it's 24 megapixels. It's got full dual pixel autofocus. It has the worst interface. Like it's a touch screen, like a power shot style interface where you kind of have to, it has like a guided interface on it. I want to have a blurry background and then you like move the slider kind of thing.
Yeah, that's annoying.
But it also has like a bunch of weird modes. You can shoot in like monochrome with tints and stuff. So like maybe that's going to scratch a little bit of the film simulation itch.
Yeah, maybe.
And then you can like flip it over into manual mode and then you can like press the buttons on the back of the touchscreen and you like go into aperture priority and that sort of thing. So like it does have the ability to do it, even though you're going to have to maybe fight through some of the teaching you how to use a camera stuff. But this thing, for $450, you can get it in white. It's got a fully flippy screen, not an articulating screen, but it will flip all the way back up like an A6400.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Shoot a little bit of video, maybe like 1080p. And you can buy an 18mm f2 or a 22mm f2 lens that's EFM, so a little tiny pancake lens. And it's about as big as a Coolpix A.
Wow.
Or a GR3,
and
which are all smaller than an X106.
And am I seeing that this is 24 megapixels?
Yeah, dude.
I mean, that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it'd be bigger with interchangeable lenses.
That's why you get the little pancake thing on there.
Yeah, you'd have to get the pancake lens.
It's hard to find one that doesn't come with the kit zoom, which is like a 14 to 45 or something. And that kit zoom is horrible.
Yeah, you probably don't even want that.
Yeah, you don't want that. I mean, you could get crazy with, like, it's an EFM. You could get an adapter. You could get like a $3,500, like 85mm 1.2. Slap it on this thing.
You could.
Sure could. I'm just saying there's growth possibilities, Daniel.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of options in this space, you know, and it's interesting that as you stop caring about having the latest features and the best image quality, you know, all of a sudden you've got tons of camera choices that aren't that expensive.
I think what we're learning is that people want bad cameras. And old cameras.
That's what it seems like.
Cheap. And this is all spawned, obviously, from the X100.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what are the alternates? And as we keep digging into older, more esoteric cameras, I don't even know if that's the right word. We just keep digging. There's cameras for days, Daniel. There's so many cameras.
Cameras for days.
All right. So watch your Google search trends.
Yeah. We'll see which one of these people.
One of them's going to take off. It's probably the Coolpix A, but I'm thinking the PowerShot N.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of potential for this guy. It's very cute. Super tiny.
Yeah. I think that one does have the right look, mm-hmm. not in terms of the pictures it takes, but in terms of its appearance.
Yeah. I don't want to see the pictures out of that thing. Keep them to yourself. Okay. I don't want to get into the rest of this topic. Talk to me a little bit about our podcast editing, Daniel. Let's get a little navel gazy.
Podcast AI. So this is, I think, the fourth episode of this show that we've edited using AI. And that's definitely a change for us. So we've always kind of edited it manually. I've done it in Logic Pro and, you know, just listen through the whole show and cut out long silences, cut out parts where one of us coughs, you know, things like that. And we've started using AI for that.
Talk to me about what that looks like. What kind of, you tried a bunch of different tools, right?
Yeah. So there's a lot of different options out there. One of the first, if you search for this online, one of the first ones you'll find is something called Auphonic, which is, I mean, all these are ultimately paid services, but Auphonic seems like it's maybe one of the first ones that came out, and it's really low level. So you get a lot of settings that you can, you know, adjust and change and all that, which is maybe cool, but I had a hard time figuring out what settings to use. And I tried that one probably a year ago and ultimately didn't end up using it just because I didn't really want to mess with all the settings, and it just seemed like I wasn't immediately finding something I liked. But more recently I've tried some other things. So Adobe has something called Adobe Podcast. That one just seems like it cleans up audio. So it didn't really do what I wanted in terms of, like, you know, I want to be able to give it your track and my track and have it look at both of those together and mute one of us when we're not talking and, you know, balance the audio between them. And it doesn't seem like it does any of that. It seems like it's just like, here's one audio track, clean that up, which is really useful. It's just not what I wanted. our podcast host, which is Podbean, also has its own AI thing they just came out with where you can give it a track and it'll do leveling and cleaning it up and stuff. But and that one worked pretty well. I did try that on an episode, and I think you listened to it. It sounded pretty decent.
Yeah, it was okay.
Mm-hmm. But the again, the shortcoming of that one is you're just giving it one flat track. So for both of us, it's just a single track. And so it had some weird problems with, like, ramping up and down our audio as we were talking. So, like, if you started talking over me or something, it would try and, like, lower my audio level and raise yours. And I just felt like it wasn't really doing a good
job. Well, right. If it doesn't have the two different tracks, it seems like that would be very hard to accomplish.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, I've kind of tried all these different things. And the one that I ended up really liking is called Resound. And that's resound.fm. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Is it Resound or Resound?
Resound. Who knows? I don't know.
Resound?
It could be any Resound? Of those. It could be all of those.
Resound?
Anyway, this one actually uses Auphonic under the hood, but they put, like, a nicer interface on it and give you some other features. But what I like about it is you can give it multiple tracks. So it is able to handle, you know, both of our individual tracks, and I even give it our music track and all that, and it can handle all that stuff together.
Do you know how many tracks it can handle?
I think that there's different plans. We're on one that can do four.
Okay, so we can have two guests.
Indeed, yeah, and you can get,
but no more.
You can pay and get more. But more if you want.
One of those guests has to be the music.
Yes. But the other cool thing about Resound is that, you know, it goes through and analyzes your stuff, and then it has an editor in the tool where you can see all the edits it's made. So where it's removed silences, you know, or you can actually have it take out filler words, ums and uhs and stuff, which I don't do, but you can have it do that. After you have an edit, though, you can, it can go, like, it can show you all those edits, and you can, you know, accept or reject all of them, which, like, that's great, because that means, you know, if we let it edit the show and then it does one thing we don't like, you know, like if you have comedic timing for a joke and it cuts out the silence for that comedic timing, I can go back in and I can just say, no, like, leave that silence in. And it's cool to have that option.
So you basically has taken the task from you of going through and cutting and removing silences and adjusting and making all the adjustments. And it does all that for you. And then you just listen back and say yes or no and make final tweaks.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's basically it.
So for me, instead of having to sit there and, you know, hands-on edit the podcast for, you know, an hour and a half or whatever it takes me to listen through and make changes and all that stuff, instead of doing that, I can just put my earbuds in and listen to it while I'm doing chores around the house. And if I hear something I don't like, I can make note of what time, you know, that happened at, and then I can go in and fix it later. So way, way better.
I'm really excited about a lot of these. I'm getting tired of the branding, for one, and everything being AI. I'm getting tired of saying it, just like I was tired of saying, was it machine learning a while ago?
Yeah, that was the thing before AI.
What was the other thing that we were saying besides machine learning?
I don't know.
Was that also AI? No. Whatever. It doesn't matter. I'm getting a little tired of hearing the word AI.
Yeah. Yeah. It is everywhere. But in this case, it seems like it really is. It really is providing something that, you know, used to be a manual process and doesn't necessarily.
It feels
have
like
to
we've kind of gotten over that hump of the ability to train these models into doing more and more useful things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's super cool that you can just like feed it the track and it can kind of do these more monotonous tasks. And I'm super pumped to see more of that kind of like work its way into photo video workflows.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like we've seen the generative fills and that sort of thing from Photoshop, and Adobe's been like pushing more and more on the image related stuff. And I know that a lot of people are really worried about like, what is this going to do for like stock footage and what's it going to do for, you know, content creators and blah, 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 blah. I'm honestly like super pumped about the idea of being able to go in and like type up something and have it just generate me a video for stock footage.
Oh yeah.
We have access to, I think we've used, what is it? Elgato or something.
Envato.
Envato, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I've looked at that. I've looked at Storyblocks. I've looked at a lot of different stock footage sites. And I know like the story stuff that we do has been fairly specific, but I've looked for a lot of different things of like, all right, I'm looking for a police officer entering a scene, or I'm looking for like drone footage of like a church or like the inside of a church, or I'm looking for, you know, like a car or like this kind of building, or, you know, an old sign. It's just like a lot of different, very specific things. Cause sometimes you're like, you don't have the footage or the time to like go shoot the footage to get a very specific whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've found is that everyone just uploads the same stupid stuff to all the sites. And so, like, they basically have all the same thing for, like, when I search the term, like, oh, I've seen that video before, I've seen that one before, I've seen that one before. And it's only okay. Like, whenever I start actually drilling into looking for the things that I'm looking for that aren't, like, really, really stock, you know, like, man-handing somebody a piece of paper.
Yeah.
It's, maybe I'm bad at searching, and I need to use AI to improve my search queries for stock footage. But I think that being able to give a very specific prompt and have it be able to generate it close enough that I can show 3 seconds of a generated clip, that's like a game changer for me.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's maybe that's taking away from someone else who like could have made money off of that stock footage. But up to this point, they haven't successfully made the thing that I'm looking for in the first place. And so I feel like I'm not actually taking anything from anybody.
I'm more interested in the editing side of things. So, I mean, I'm thinking about, we have a project coming up that we're going to take on, or we're doing a training video. And so the video footage has been filmed. So we have an A roll of somebody talking, going through this thing. And then we know that at certain points in that video, they want to show bullet points on the screen, you know, with like, these are our 3 key points for this section. We want to show those as like animated text things.
Right.
And, you know, maybe you want to have some B roll in there and stuff, but we've got a script written for this whole thing. So we've got a script. We have somebody speaking through the text parts. We have bullet points where we want the bullet points. I'm like,
why can't you just feed the script, give it the A roll and say, make the bullet points and put them in the spot where they're supposed to go?
Exactly.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. And there's no reason it shouldn't be able to do that. And I don't think that's taking a job away from anyone. Cause like,
it's making your job easier.
Does anybody listening to this podcast really want to sit there and edit through that whole thing? Like, that's not what you want to spend your time doing. You want it to do that for you, and then you can go in and stylistically, like, I want to focus on the color grading, or I want to, you know, tweak these animations to make them just right. Like, that's the kind of stuff you want to do.
Yeah.
Not like the grunt work of, you know, let me put this video together so that it matches the script, and let me type in all these text bullet points. Like, you don't want to do that.
Yeah, for sure. I do think that that's where I'm most excited about AI, is looking past, like, is it taking away jobs, or what is it? Is it doing things that, you know, people actually want to do and whatever? And more of looking at how is it improving and getting me to the results that I'm looking for faster?
Mm-hmm.
And that way I can iterate more, and I can like really zero in. If I could go into like DaVinci Resolve and say, hey, here is a video or a picture or a look that I did. It could be something that I edited. Like, oh, I did this 2 years ago and I can't remember what I did, or here's my favorite movie. And like, I just give it a screenshot and have it analyze and then apply and then just do the grade for me, like create the node tree and add all the things. And then I can go through and like, maybe like tweak a few things here and there, maybe like, you know, adjust some gain or whatever, and then like finish it up to what I want. That'd be amazing.
Yeah.
It'd be so great. Cause it would save me a ton of time of doing the matching myself. And then, you know, I like I have a fantastic starting point. Then I can focus on fine tuning or, you know, iterating on that look.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think we've ever worked on a project where we think, you know, I'm done and I could spend no more time on this project. There's always more you could do. And,
yeah.
And I would say, if anything, we're usually shipping projects sooner than we would like. I mean,
for sure.
Know, in a perfect world, we'd love to spend more time tweaking it, more time adding stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I don't like to think about this stuff in, you know, in a term of like, this is taking my job away, because it's just that those aren't the parts that I want to spend my time.
Yeah. It's not so much this normally would have taken me 4 hours, so I would have billed 4 hours, but now it's taking me two, so I can only justify billing two and I'm making half the amount. And now I have to like find something else to fill that time. It's now I have two more hours that I can make it that much better.
Exactly.
And you can provide an even higher quality product, which then like you could probably charge more for.
Yeah.
And so it really, really ups the game and the ability of like things that you can do.
Yeah. And it feels like right now we're really just scratching the surface of what's possible. And mm-hmm. even what we've seen has been great. Like the transcription editing in Resolve is fantastic. This podcast editing stuff is really saving a lot of time, but this feels like early days for this stuff. And
for
so
sure.
I'm really interested to see where it goes.
Yeah. And I'm super excited for editing stuff. And that's what I wanted to kind of mention and talk about is like, surprise, this episode was edited by AI. Yep. Lol. But I mean, it's kind of cool that you basically get that time back. I mean, you still are listening through the edit, but it's not 100% your attention.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you can now focus on other things and it's great.
Yep. Yeah. It's a cool world. Glad we're seeing some of this stuff happen.
Definitely. Okay. Enough about AI. I feel like we don't talk about AI a lot, and I think that's good because everyone else is talking about it. I'm tired of hearing about it.
I agree.
But something that we can talk about is the Rolly 35.
Oh man, is this going to become a segment of the show? This is at least the third episode you mentioned this.
This is the third episode I mentioned it, but that's because we're coming up on it. So I talked about Mint and how they like refab old cameras and that sort of thing. There's like more details and rumors about the Rolly 35 AF.
Oh my gosh.
Because they're coming out with another, Daniel, they're like rehousing it. It's going to be a whole thing. But the word on the street is they're not just rehousing it. This is basically a whole new camera built in the image of the Rolly 35.
But they're still calling it the Rolly 35, aren't they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
We're still looking at this thing because it's going to be 35 millimeter film, f2.8 lens, or probably 35 millimeter lens, five elements, that sort of thing. Looking at a full metal body, it's going to look just like the Rolly, like the old one, nice compact with the dials on the front. And they're shooting for 650 to 800. So, you know, information's still coming out. I think they're still shooting for like maybe this summer. I don't know. I'm super pumped though.
I mean, are you going to get one of these things?
I really want to. I think it'd be super, super cool.
I mean, maybe this is your X106.
Sure could be, Daniel. I wonder how hard it will be to get these and how many people are actually going to buy them.
Yeah. I mean, my guess is they're going to sell pretty well just because this is a small market. They're not going to make 50,000 of these things, you know?
No, definitely not. I get excited about, you know, new film cameras and new film emulsions and just that market staying, any sign that shows that the film market is staying alive. Like, for instance, Fuji started making more film. They said that they're shutting down film production, and then people are now finding new Fuji, like, film, Fuji film? Huh? Fuji film? that's like, production dated this year.
Oh, man.
And so
they're so like sneakily making new film.
They're making more film, Daniel. I'm saying, like, we talked about the Harman Phoenix stuff.
Yeah.
We've been talking about the Pentax rumors that they're coming out with 35 millimeter camera.
This is another hot trend in the camera market that the Camera Gear Podcast is right on top of.
Right on top of.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm just super pumped about it. And so I wanted to update everybody on the progress of the new Rolly 35.
Cool. Well, if you're a film hipster like Lucas, you can check out the link in the notes and find out more about that camera.
It's not much more. It's from the website japancamerahunter.com.
Which is pretty cool branding, if we're being honest.
Oh, boys, it's just so niche.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay, Daniel, we shot a music video, and I was going to talk about this last week,
uh-huh.
and then I moved it to this week, and now it feels really out of context from everything
that
we're talking about.
It does, but we're here, and so we're doing it, right?
Okay, yep. We're just pounding through these topics.
Yeah, we are.
All right. What was exciting about this music video?
Well, what was different about it is that we shot it at a rentable studio space and they had a psych wall.
Super fun.
Yeah. First time we've gotten to shoot in that environment.
Took a picture of myself, or you took a picture of me on the psych wall, and it was like I was standing in space.
Yeah.
But like white space.
Yep.
Like if space, like outer space, are you familiar with outer space, Daniel?
I think I've heard of it.
If it was invented by Johnny Ive.
Yes. So if you're listening to this and you don't know what that is, a psych wall is basically...
Yes, if you're listening to this and you don't know what outer space is...
We can't help you then. Look up. Look up into the sky. Now, if you don't know what a psych wall is, it's basically a picture like a corner of a room, but there are no hard edges. So everything's kind of smoothed out. It kind of looks like a skate park a little bit.
Yeah.
And kind of the purpose is that you can take a picture of, you know, a person or a car or whatever and not have any... like the background is just a completely unbroken, you know, white or colored square.
Right. Yeah. It looks continuous because of the curvature from between the floor and the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the light reflects typically off of a well-built psych wall, you can't really see the reflections or the shadows. And so you truly do see the background basically go to nothing.
Yeah.
And it's very focused on just the subject. It's like people in an empty room.
Yeah.
It's super cool.
It's a cool effect. And the studio was set up really well. They had some lights mounted in the ceiling.
They had like six panel lights kind of over top. They were all RGB. So you could use them to tint the wall and like change the color that way because it was painted white.
Yep.
And or you could use them just light the room. And then they had a lantern globe, like aperture style light.
And we ended up bringing in two of our own lights to use basically as the key lights. So you have the lights in the ceiling that were lighting up the back wall. But then we had our own lights to actually light the talent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we used theirs as the overhead light as a fill. So the back wall lights, then the one light as a fill.
Yeah.
I just thought it was kind of cool. First time we shot on a psych wall, and it was interesting to figure that out because like the way that studio was set up, there was still like too much shadow, kind of like depending upon how you lit it. You still had to be really careful with the lights, and because it's like a white wall and you're shining light on it, it was so bright.
It was so bright. And then metering on the cameras would kind of get thrown off by it.
Yeah.
Because you'd look at the metering and, you know, if you have it on spot metering to where it's just looking at the center, then maybe that's okay. You just point at a person. But, you know, if you're trying to meter the whole scene, it sees that white wall and it's just like, it's way overexposed. And,
yeah. I definitely had to deal with that. I was like, just put your fingers around like on one side and then frame the person. It was kind of tough. It's like, this is why it's really nice to have waveform.
Yeah, for sure.
And I mean, that's how I exposed all the cameras. It's like we shot on the Lumix and we shot on the XH2Ss, and I like used the monitors for the Fuji to pull up a waveform, and then they used the built-in one on the Lumix because thank you Panasonic. And like literally it's like, okay, these people are going to there's my person. There's their skin. Let's get them between like 540 and 640 on the vectorscope. And like, that'll be really close to middle gray but like skin tones.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a perfect example of where a waveform comes in handy.
Oh, it's perfect. It's great. So, but like otherwise couldn't really trust the meter, and I don't want to just trust the back of the screen either. Cause I'm always going to underexpose.
Sure. Yeah. Cool experience.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think there's anything else super exciting to talk about. Oh, like two more things maybe. And this is, you know, this is actually just going to skip ahead to a topic. One, we did shoot more stuff on the S5 Mark II, and I always keep forgetting that it doesn't shoot 422 in 6K, even at lower frame rates. I thought maybe like you were shooting at 30. I always forget that. So it's like we had to decide, do we want to shoot 420 6K or 422 4K? And I hate having to make those decisions.
I know. I don't remember which one we chose.
We shot in 4K, 422 4K.
Okay.
Because I wanted the higher color fidelity because I'm going to be doing some really... It's a music video, and so I have a little more leeway to get a little funky with the color grade versus a lot of the other stuff that we produce, which is kind of like maybe... I'm usually going for like a contrasty saturated maybe and... He lit the shadows a little bit. I'm mostly like kind of moving white balance and tint around to like create a feel instead of doing really weird stuff that you can do in a music video.
Right.
So I wanted the better color fidelity, but either way, annoying. And I like it when cameras don't make me make that decision.
Yeah.
What's the ideal number of people to shoot a music video? And I know that like that's an impossible question to answer, but how many camera operators do you think you need?
Yeah, so that is it's going to depend on the video, but what was interesting for us is we had fewer operators for this one than we normally do. So when we've shot a couple of videos before, and we've had, you know, maybe up to 5 camera operators. And this time we had 3.
I feel like we've done like 6.
Maybe we have.
We've done a lot of angles before.
Yeah. And this time we only had 3 of us, you and me being 2 of them. And we did set up 2 static cameras. But we kind of, those were very much like not critical shots.
Yeah.
And, you know, we figured we'd be able to use it some, but we weren't afraid to walk in front of those cameras or anything like that.
Sure.
But honestly, I really liked having fewer people. I felt like it made everything a lot easier to coordinate, you know, just like when you kind of huddle everybody up before you start and say, you know, you're going to stand here, you're going to stand there, doing that kind of thing. That's just so much easier with fewer people.
I equate it to the concept of, like, I know like shooting coverage is a different thing, but whenever you go to shoot something, you have to kind of decide, like, am I going to strategically shoot like each of the things, or am I going to cover it from 1,000 different angles?
Yeah.
And I feel like every time you add an angle, it adds a level of complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And on the face of it, it feels like if you're shooting like a music video, and you're not even shooting like something that's narrative, you're like, let's shoot the band, get a lot of angles, and then cut it in post. It's like, oh, well, yeah, sure. We'll just add a fourth person. We'll just add a fifth person, right? Like, it's more angles. It's just better. And in the end, it's like, one, you're dealing with another operator, you're having to instruct them, you're having to make sure that like they're all, everything on their camera's set up and it's all matching. And like, there's just this one extra level of overhead that's associated with that angle. And it's like, if you're going to shoot an explosion, I mean, like dealing with all those extra angles, it's just more work. And it's like, it becomes a point where there's a cost benefit to it that I think maybe is not as apparent on the face of it.
Yeah.
As far as just how much coordination actually just is involved and then dealing with it in post,
mm-hmm.
as far as all the extra angles and syncing and that sort of thing.
Honestly, if you want an extra angle, if it's something that you can easily repeat, like a music video, you can just play the song again.
Sure.
Like, I would rather do another take with a smaller number of operators than have more operators for fewer takes.
I would tend to agree. I think that it's something that I'm going to think about more for like a lot of the stuff that we do in the future, as far as, you know, how many angles are we actually setting up? And, oh, like, let's just add a static cam. Let's do like one more angle. It's free. It's not free.
No.
You're like, you're setting it up. You're looking at the foot. Like, it's just one more thing. And like, there's a cost benefit to it. And especially if you're getting paid to do the work and like you're charging your time, you really have to figure out, you know, how much is reasonable here and how does that play into my budget and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, even one static angle, it's like, now I've got to bring another tripod. Mm-hmm. I've got to spend time setting up that camera. I have to make sure I'm keeping batteries in it or powering it, however I'm powering it. Then I've got to deal with that footage. I have to color grade it to match. I mean, yeah, it's a lot of work.
Yeah. I think until we did this video, I was kind of like a mo camera, mo better stance on all of this, even with a lot of like the interview stuff that we shoot, just mo camera, mo better. and realistically, like sometimes we don't even use half the angles and you know what? Let's just save the time and not deal with it.
I think that's easier once you have the confidence, you know, once you have a few projects under your belt though.
Because yeah, that's true.
I think a lot of times we've treated having more cameras as, you know, like a safety net, but as you do more things, you kind of get a better trust in your gear and in your process, and maybe you don't need that as much.
Totally. One of the cameras that we shot with was your X-T5.
Yep, which you weren't. We talked about this last week, but you were surprised by that going in.
Yep, definitely surprised. And one thing that I noted that, I knew this, but I had forgotten, the X-T5 shoots 6K, but it's an 8K sensor, and it doesn't have enough heat dissipation to shoot 8K like the XH2.
Right.
So it shoots 6K. And when I see 6K on a camera, I go, sweet, open gate.
Yeah.
Not open gate. And I thought it was until I brought it in post. And I was like, where's the top and the bottom of my image?
That's 16:9.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it crops in on it. So it's not, it's I don't remember, it's like a 1.5 crop or something.
No, it's not that much. Okay, like 1.23 maybe.
Okay, sure. Whatever. Honestly, I didn't care. Crop, whatever. I want to get, I'm getting 6K at basically a slightly oversampled or close to a 1:1.
Yeah.
Cool. It is the same horizontal resolution as the XH2. And so I was happy to see that.
As the XH2S, you mean?
Thank you. As the XH2S. So the even the XH2S, I'm going to, you know, zoom in and crop down. And so like upon making the top bottom crop for the XH2S, my width dimension, same for all the footage. So, you know, two thumbs up for that. I'm really happy to see that they're matching those pixels. So those cameras are going to match. We shot this all in, what did we shoot? Did we shoot an F-Log or F-Log 2? I think we shot an F-Log 1 because the walls were really bright and we didn't want to have to throw NDs on anything.
I do think that's right.
And we didn't need the extended dynamic range. I do think, like, we've been shooting a lot more stuff in F-Log 1, and I think I still miss shooting in F-Log 2 more because you get, if you're shooting in the, at the 30 frames per second on XH2S, you get the bitter cutler fidelity, you get the 14-bit, so it's like...
You probably just need to get some NDs. And
you get, like, slightly extended dynamic range, but the F-Log 1 stuff is cleaner. Like, it's no, like, there is less noise. Mm-hmm. I have to do less noise reduction, and it... I mean, I kind of like the noise out of it, and it kind of gives it a little more of like a naturally... Stop it. It gives it more of a film look. Shut up. I like the way it looks. And I think we should shoot more in F-Log 2, even though we've been doing a lot of stuff in F-Log 1. Point is, the X-T5, I didn't even pick a different LUT.
Really?
Like, you know, you whenever you go to Fuji's website to pull their LUTs, you can like... Actually, no, I didn't even do that. Never mind. I did test this. I did take the XH2S F-Log LUT and I threw it on the X-T5 and it was matchy-matchy.
Wow.
So that was really cool.
That's good to hear.
I did use the F-Log color space transformation in DaVinci Resolve. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I used the... Maybe we did shoot an F-Log 2 and I used the... No, I can't even remember anymore. The Airy C-Log 3 is like the closest gamma in DaVinci Resolve.
I think I remember
it's
us like talking about
the
that
most pleasing looking to me, and so that's what I've been using for my F-Log 2 color transforms. I did one or the other, but the footage basically perfectly matches. Basically perfectly blah blah blah. And that's what I wanted to report. I was excited to have an X-T5 footage actually like in Resolve, mm-hmm. to screw around with, and dimensions match for the horizontal width, and it is almost a perfect match to the XH2S footage.
You said there was, you said like the light fall off was a little different or something.
Okay,
right?
Yeah, that is a good point. We shot an interview also with it, and the angle for the XT5 was very, very similar to the angle that we shot for one of the XH2Ss. We shot one at 23 millimeter and one at 56 millimeter. Mm-hmm.
Now we were using different lenses.
That's what I mean. We had the 56-1.2 shooting at about 1.8 or whatever, and then we had the 23-1.4 shooting at about 1.4-1.8. So, and the cameras were almost on top of each other. And in Resolve, shooting an F-Log 1 and comparing the footage, the light roll off for, you know, the hottest part of this person's face, the brightest part as it goes into the shadowy part of their face, was harsher on the X-T5.
Interesting.
The roll off, the look, like, you know, if you look at a curve for your Luma, and you're thinking of like, how does that curve like literally have a curve to it as you're going from shadow to highlight?
Yeah.
It's just like when transformed and looking at the footage, it wasn't as smooth for the X-T5 compared.
Interesting.
And I think that just comes down to like the bit depth and the extra like bit information that you are getting out of those XH2S files are just a little better. I do think maybe part of it is that because we were shooting on 128 gig cards and not CF Express cards, I shot the X-T5 at 200 megabit per second, and I shot the XH2S at 360 megabit per second.
Could be a
so
difference.
That is probably a big part of it.
It's also a different lens. I mean, lenses just behave differently in some
Very
ways.
True. Yeah. It's just it was interesting to me to be color balancing these shots.
Yeah.
And I had to do a lot more work on the X-T5 to get that fall off just right, so it didn't look like he had a hot spot on his face.
Right.
But it was more of this very gradual like fall off into the shadow, mm-hmm. and contrasty look. So X-T5 seems great.
Yeah.
The camera is just awesome with the pictures and everything. And it seems like it's a very good addition to like a counterpart to the XH2S. I know we've kind of been like thinking about it for a while, but now that we actually have one in our hands, it pairs as well as I could ever hope.
Yeah, it's good to hear that it's a good B or C camera for these setups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's going to be really easy to match the footage. We can get a 6K even though it's cropped in.
Mm-hmm.
And you got F-Log 2 and all this sort of thing. Yeah. So great.
Great. I'm glad to hear that.
I think we need bigger cards.
Yes, I think so. You know, 128 has normally been fine because you know, since we got the XH2Ss, we've been shooting on the CF Express, and we have 320 gig CF Express cards, which is plenty.
Have become spoiled in that, like, if I'm shooting 4K, I'll 200, like, fine, that's fine. When I shoot 6K, I'm like, mm-hmm. I want to go up one more. I want to shoot like 360 or more. I'm not a monster shooting like whatever 720 megabits per second. But if you're shooting 360 megabits per second, I mean, if you shoot an hour, it's like 120 gigs, 130 gigs.
Yep. So, yeah, I think we need to get a 256.
Go yeah, on. For sure. We just, whenever they had that deal when you bought the XH2S, they're like, here's a free 300 and
oh, whatever. Oh, wonderful.
350 gigabyte CF Express card. It's like a $400 card.
Mm-hmm.
That thing's great.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I love it.
I just pick whatever data rate I want. I'm like, I don't care.
Yep.
I'll shoot in ProRes.
And then it downloads as fast as an SSD. Like, mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Yep. Mm. Anyways, whatever.
Yeah.
I think we're going long, Daniel.
Yes, I think we are.
All right.
Is it time to get to the main topic?
Yeah, let's skip over this Logitech webcam thing. I'm going to push that to next week.
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, so this is our camera series. We're talking about camera companies.
Indeed. Like we did OM System last week.
Yeah, we talked about OM Digital Systems. I'm just waiting for you to tell me that's wrong.
I can't tell if it's wrong or not. It seems like maybe it's wrong, maybe it's not wrong. It's like I think their name is OM Digital Solutions, but then I definitely hear a lot of people say OM Digital Systems. If you look on like B&H, if you're buying one of those cameras, it says OM System. So who knows what that company's called? I think it's funny that we didn't maybe get that exactly right, because that just kind of drives home how ridiculous the whole thing is.
We're talking about Canon. We're talking about the most popular camera company.
Now, we can all agree on their name, Canon. That's easy.
Yeah, it's Canon at that point.
Simple.
Yeah. Lol. There was an article on Petapixel that came from a review from, I forget what it was. It was some camera thing. And Canon was talking about their like 2024 and like future strategy and all this sort of thing. And they're like, guys, third year in a row, we are the most popular camera company by cameras sold, like percentage of consumer market by whatever metric we've chosen to use to determine this. And we want more. We don't care that we're like 46% of the camera market. We want to be an overwhelming number one in the mirrorless market by 2026. 2 years.
So I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But I respect the drive that they have there. And I respect them saying, like, this is our goal and this is what we're going to try to achieve. And I'm like, cool. Like, I think as a consumer, we win when companies want to win. And I'm curious to see what happens.
Yeah, I probably agree with you that it would be really annoying. Oh, here it is. I found my link for the Canon market share, which this is from Canon's website. I'm going to go ahead and load this puppy up. Oh, no, this is a different thing. Canon celebrates 21st consecutive years of number one share in global interchangeable lens digital camera market. Interesting. Anyways, whatever. They're not looking at the graph and saying, we got like 40%. We got like 45%. They just see Sony behind them.
Yep.
And they're just running for the hills, right? Well, that's the wrong word. Running for the hills would be giving up. They're just like doubling down.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to give up. We're going to like really push. We're not going to sit on our laurels and just be like, what, people are just going to keep buying it because it says Canon on the front? They're just going to keep going.
Yeah,
that's cool.
I like it.
It's innovative.
Maybe. We'll see.
Maybe. Okay. So Canon, like, that's their strategy. They're number one, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
What are they doing? Where are they going? Like, what do they have left to right now, Canon is working on R mount, right? They've gone full mirrorless. They're basically done with all their DSLR style cameras, and they're sitting here on top of the market. What is left for them to do and invest in? Are they done with their R line of cameras? Have they like filled it out and now they just need to iterate? Like, what's next for Canon?
Well, we're still waiting on the R1, right?
Yeah, that's right.
We haven't gotten that yet. And so that's kind of a big question, is what is the flagship going to be? I mean, the R3 is pretty good, but they've kind of left that slot at the top of the lineup. So, I mean, I think that's one question they haven't answered yet.
I think that people have been waiting and waiting for the R1 to come out. And this being like the year of the Olympics, I've heard rumor that the R3 was supposed to be the R1 and then they chickened out right at the last minute. So it seems like imminently, like within the next month or two, we may see a Canon R1.
Yep. Could be exciting.
Like top of the line, like that's coming. Mm. And that's gonna be the like global sensor or like dual gain stack sensor, you know, super fancy pants camera.
Mm-hmm.
It's rumored that it's gonna be like 30 megapixels.
Seems low. Honestly.
It does seem low. I think at one point people were postulating that the R1 could be 100 megapixels and could start, you know, oh, Canon's going to give medium format a run for their money. You don't need a giant sensor to get a huge amount of resolution, blah, blah, blah.
Well, 30 would be a far cry from that. And I don't think they could I don't know how they would justify it because, you know, you can get something like an A9 Mark III that can shoot really fast, even with a high megapixel sensor. So, you know, I don't know what they'd be getting for that 30 megapixels.
So, the current rumors don't seem to indicate global, like maybe Canon hasn't quite figured it out yet.
Because they make their own sensors, so they would have to figure it out.
Right, exactly. But the rumors are suggesting that we're looking at no mechanical shutter, like a Z9, and 120 frames per second continuous burst with 240 for an optional, like, faster burst.
So that's going to be a lot of data.
Mm-hmm. But it's like A9 Mark III territory.
Yeah, that's kind of the point I'm making is, I mean, with the A9 III coming out, that shows that you can get that with a high megapixel count, which is make 30 megapixels feel pretty low.
The A9 Mark III isn't it 30 megapixels?
Is it?
Like 20? It's not.
Okay.
It's not Z8 territory. It's not a 45 megapixel sensor.
I guess you're right.
It's like 23 or 26.
So maybe it would be competitive then.
So, I mean, it's kind of like, maybe it's probably going to be the same price point. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be global. But it's just another super fast camera, but that's kind of what the R3 is.
Yeah.
So maybe it's the R3, but better. And that kind of leaves their high megapixel portrait stills camera to the R5.
Yeah, which is getting pretty old.
Right. So there is rumor that there's probably going to be an R5 Mark II this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really curious to see what they do with that. Like, Sony's gone to 60 megapixels.
Yeah.
Are we going to see a 60 megapixel Canon or is it going to be 45?
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely an open question.
Do you think they need to push for higher resolution?
I mean, I think I would have previously said no, but I was honestly shocked when I saw the difference in detail between the X-T5 and some of the older Fuji cameras.
Yeah. Going from a 26 to a 40 megapixel image.
Which, I mean, granted, that's like a, you know, almost a 2x increase, you know, so maybe going from 45 to 60 won't be quite as noticeable. But I mean, I'm kind of thinking maybe it does matter. You know, if you've got a really good lens and you're shooting, you know, pictures in good lighting and all that, maybe having the extra megapixels does give you enough extra detail to be worth it.
I think that there's another quote from Canon along the lines of, there are no cameras that produce high enough resolution images for the Vision Pro. So maybe they still think that there's room to improve.
Maybe so. And Canon, and that's an interesting quote too, because Canon has those weird, you know, like
they have that
not novelty, but they have those unusual lenses that are for shooting VR stuff.
There's just one of them, right? They don't have more than one.
I thought they had a couple of different things. I mean, they have the one that has the two lenses, but I thought they had something else that was also for VR type stuff. I don't remember, but
they're kind of the only one who's doing something like that. I mean, it's clear that Canon is thinking about how to capture VR.
Yeah.
So I don't expect we're going to see much in that regard this year, but I would be surprised if we didn't start seeing some innovation from Canon related to, like, how are we capturing stereoscopic photo and stereoscopic video.
Yeah. It does seem like more than the other big brands, they've been kind of dabbling in that world, and I could see it happening.
Yep. Other things that we may be seeing this year or maybe next year, for a while it's been rumored that there's going to be more cinema cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned this like a couple months ago. I thought 2024 was going to be the year of cinema cameras for Canon. We've been waiting on the C300 Mark III, the C500 Mark IV.
I think that's right.
Or I might have those backwards. There's rumor of maybe like a C50. There's rumor of a C70 Mark II.
Yeah. And I mean, Canon cinema cameras have always been really well regarded. And the C70 in particular, you know, it's only a couple of years old now. But I mean, that camera, from everything I've heard, is outstanding.
There's been some rumor of Canon developing a 14-bit dual gain sensor for their cinema line,
mm-hmm.
which would be amazing, right? Yep. That's like red area territory as far as, you know, getting that bit depth off of the sensor. I think those are like areas the 18-bit and
right.
red 16, but still not a lot of 14-bit readout for video other than like high-end cinema cameras and the X-H2S. So 14-bit, you get more dynamic range, dual gain, even more on top of that. It's able to solidify itself again in the market if they came out with a C70 with those specs as yeah. far as most dynamic range. So yeah. they could stick that sensor in something like a C500 or a C300. Don't know. There's really like, it's not for sure where that might go, but there is a rumor out about a sensor mm-hmm. of that caliber,
I mean,
stacked sensor.
I feel like their cinema camera line is a good market for them. You know, it's a higher... Most of that stuff comes at a higher price than the standalone cameras, but I mean, it seems like they're pretty popular, you know, people making documentaries, that sort of thing. And I hope they keep investing in that lineup.
Do you think that anything changes for Canon now that Red has the backing of Nikon?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I kind of think not, though. So the RF mount is the interesting part of that to me, because in terms of cameras, I feel like Red cameras kind of operate in a different space than Canon's cinema line, because to me, Canon's cinema line seems closer to something like the Burano, where it's more, I mean, the obvious direct comparison is Sony's FX series, but it's closer to something like the Burano, where I feel like the Canon stuff is, you know, maybe a little bit more targeted toward run and gun. Maybe you need a little bit less rigging to run them. Whereas with something like a Red, to me, that feels truly like a cinema setup. You're gonna have a complicated workflow for getting your footage, you know, and all that stuff. And I just don't see Red really operating in the same market as cameras like the C500. But
yeah, I don't know how many people are shooting like movies and that sort of thing on a C500, C300.
That's kind of what I'm getting at.
It's really maybe more like high end commercial. Maybe yeah. it's that sort of thing.
Yeah, documentaries, music videos, commercials, like sure. that sort of thing.
But things like the Burano encroaching in at that $20,000 price point, and now Nikon having access to what Red's... And like Red is, like, you're going to shoot in raw and color graded. The C500 maybe is less of that type of camera. But it kind of... It feels like there's heat building up in this $10,000 to $20,000 like cinema
yeah.
high-end video camera range that, you know, maybe a few years ago you were looking at, I mean, like a used Red maybe, and like the Canon stuff, there wasn't too much in that higher end range. Like you could sure. get some lower end stuff from like Mavo or Confinity or whatever, but I don't know, it's interesting to start seeing more competition around there, and I'm curious to see what Canon does, because I think that the C500 is getting a little old.
Yeah, I agree.
So, video cameras are a big thing. We talked about the R1, we talked about the R5. What else does Canon need to do this year? They addressed a lot of the low end market in 2023
mm-hmm.
with the R100 and the R50 and the R8. I think they still sell Rebels.
Which is kind of surprising, right?
Yeah, and that's like you buy the camera and the lens and you're out the door for the cost of an R100.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think, I mean, it feels like the Apple strategy of just, you know, keep selling it. Do you think that Canon needs to do something about that low end? I feel like them being such a high percentage of the market share, like a lot of professionals shoot Canon. Like they're very reliable. The grips are really good. Sure, the R5 overheats, but I also feel like those T6, you know, Rebel cameras sell.
Yeah,
because people are like, oh, I want to get a camera. It looks like a camera.
Yeah, yeah. It has. I've seen Canon. I've heard that name, and mm-hmm. I can afford this one, and it looks like a camera. Yeah, I think that is absolutely a market.
So, but how much of that were the best selling camera of the last 21 years
mm-hmm.
is the Rebel line?
Good question.
I don't know how well they break that out, but I wonder if they're ever going to move that to mirrorless and we're going to see more things like the R100, like maybe an R1000 or something.
Yeah, I mean, if the R100 is the best they can do in terms of features at a price point, then I think the Rebel will be around for a few more years, because mm-hmm. you know, I don't really love the the value you get with the R100.
It's not great.
But I, you'd have to imagine eventually they would want to get rid of, get rid of DSLRs just because, you know, that's a whole production line to maintain. It's got to be complicated. So I don't know.
Yeah, you think they'd want to be able to shut those down and move full yeah, mirrorless. I mean, they're just more complicated anyway, and I think that people are used enough to looking at screens. I think that if you're coming from a smartphone, it's easier to shoot on a mirrorless camera than it is to shoot on a DSLR.
Oh, I agree for sure.
Are you familiar with the Canonet Q17?
I'm not. What's that?
It is a 35mm rangefinder film camera.
Here we go.
With, I think it's like a 35 or 40mm lens. And it's 1.7.
Okay.
And it's super adorable. And there is rumor that Canon has seen what Fuji's doing, and they might come out with another Canonet.
So a digital camera, but something that would compete with the X100 VI.
Yeah, exactly.
That'd be interesting.
I'm here for it.
Well, and I mean,
I want to see a digital version of the Canonet.
And I mean, Nikon has the ZFC. And the ZF, which are not, I know those are interchangeable lens, and this would, I assume, not be, but, you know, Nikon's kind of done that retro styling type thing, and it'd be interesting to see Canon do that as well, and maybe also, you know, hitting that X100 VI type market of, you know, a fixed lens, really small camera. I like that.
Look at this. It's just like a little tiny, adorable, looks yeah. like a film camera.
I mean, yeah, that looks like, looks like the Fuji X100 series. It's very similar styling.
Looks kind of like a toy.
Yeah, it does.
Very small. Anyway, could happen.
Yeah. I mean, that would, you know, if they want to be an overwhelming percentage of the market, they're going to have to play in all the spaces that are in the market. And that's one that they're not hitting right now. So I could see it happening.
For sure. I don't know what... As far as rumor, it's just kind of like they maybe it's in development. This may happen. I would expect if they did this, it would be an APS-C. But I feel like if you really want to compete, like similar to what we were talking about last week, if you really want to compete with Fujifilm in that market, you got to go full frame.
Yeah, I mean, because like, you got to stand out against them. So
and like they have so many good full frame sensors. I mean, stick the R6 Mark II. In a little rangefinder.
Mm-hmm.
Canon doesn't make rangefinders.
Yeah, that's true. All their cameras are the, you know, the big bulky DSLR style.
They also don't really make any rangefinder lenses.
That's true too.
Sort of.
Which could be a problem.
Like for one, if you're shooting on a rangefinder, like you don't want the longest lens in the world because yeah. you're not gonna be able to see what you're shooting unless you had a digital viewfinder.
Right.
But two, most lenses that you want to shoot, if you're shooting like street photography, that you're going to use a rangefinder for, are going to be those wide zooms, not ultra wide. I'm talking like 24 to 50 millimeter, everything in that range. And weirdly enough, like if you go look through all the RF mount, like Canon has tons of really cool like zooms, and they have this like 28 to 70 f2, and they have that super fast like 15, 30, whatever. And they have a lot of cool zoom options. They have like very few wide primes.
Interesting.
They have like a 35 1/8.
Mm-hmm.
They have like a 28 2.8. That's like a pancake, and they got like a 24 and a 35.
But basically, they don't have anything close to what, for example, Fuji has.
Yeah, yeah. Fuji over here has like 2.16s, 2.18s, 2.23s, a 27, a 30, a 33, a 35. Yeah. It's a little nuts.
Yeah.
But let's talk full frame. Sigma makes the following lenses that Canon doesn't make. And like when I say doesn't make, Canon's wide prime stuff is all like 1.8. They don't make anything that's super fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sigma makes like a 14-1.4, a 24-1.4, a 24-1.4, 28-1.4, 35-1.2, a 41-4. And a 71-4.
It's a lot of lenses.
Canon doesn't make any of those lenses.
So wait, are those Sigma lenses for? Well, they're not Sigma L. for RF.
They'd be L and E mount.
Yeah. Okay.
And so Sony and Lumix and Leica have access to like all these like really fast, cool primes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in RF, it's like too bad.
Just out of luck, you're using Canon lenses.
Yeah, I mean, like you're shooting on an R5, you're probably shooting portraits, and so like Canon has like two or three. 85 millimeters. So you can get your 1.2 85 and you can get this amazing 135 1.8 super fast telephoto. But if you want to do like street stuff and you want to shoot like at a like 24 1.4 or a 35 1.4, too bad.
Yeah, that's a good point. They would need to fill that gap in their lineup if they're going to do something like this.
If they're never going to open up RF mount, they got to make all the lenses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which, I mean, you know, we've talked several times in this show about, you know, is Canon going to open up that mount? And I still don't know. We haven't gotten any information either way on that.
Well, there was that article on, I think it was like Petapixel or something, where Canon is rumored to be like in talks or whatever.
Yeah, but they said they were like 50% of the way there or something. Sure. Does not feel like very far.
If Canon opens it up, what I think would be really interesting, what I'd like to see is them actually collaborate and work on providing like their autofocus and interface guidelines to manufacturers, like actually open it up. Because I think that like the EF stuff was basically reverse engineered.
Yeah.
Companies just started making it because like you can, you know, what do these two wires do? Figure it out. And I think in more like modern mirrorless stuff, there's so much interconnect between the lens and the camera and like making IS and like what kind of focal length are you shooting at and like all the different things work, that if you can get a third party lens that actually communicates and like works with the system and works with the autofocus, it can be as good as a first party lens.
Right.
And I think that that's kind of the direction that most of this third party stuff has moved for these mirrorless lens mounts. And that's why like Sigma and Tamron, unless they're getting that collaboration, they're not going to go off and do like what Samyang and Rokinon are doing, where they're just like, it's a mount, right? We can just make something for it. It's literally mechanical. Why not make another lens? They want to be able to give you a first tier experience.
Yeah. Because I mean, it looks bad for a company like Sigma or Tamron if you buy that lens and it doesn't autofocus well on your camera.
Mm-hmm.
So like why would they go through all the work to reverse engineer it only to give customers an experience that's going to hurt their reputation?
Exactly. And so it just seems like they're just waiting. I know that Sigma would love to pick up that market.
Sure.
They have so many, like those are art lenses.
Well,
they'd sell all of them.
They've got all these optical designs that are just waiting in the wings that they could pull the trigger and convert all of them, but only if Canon's on board.
Yeah, and I think that's what we're waiting on, is like Canon actually has to be on board, and I don't think we're ever going to get to a point where like Sigma or Tamron just say, "Ah, screw it, we'll deal with the lawsuits. Let's just start making for RF."
I think you're right about that.
I think it has to be a full collaboration, and that's like, why isn't it happening? Why is it happened? That's what we're waiting on.
Yeah,
and I guess that's why, you know, Canon's like, oh, we're working on it.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I think the logistics of like how much money of each Sigma sale does Canon get has to get sorted out. And I think that takes as long as, you know, here's our autofocus algorithm.
I'm sure it does.
Okay. Everyone's buying Canon. We all love them. Great. Why? Like, what makes Canon better than everybody else?
It's those colors, man. Those Canon colors.
I mean, that was kind of the big deal for a while. Everyone's like, the colors are just better.
I feel like I haven't heard that as much lately.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard that as much lately either.
I mean, I'm sure people still believe it, but I don't know. That may not be as much of a differentiator anymore.
What about that dual pixel AF?
You know, that's another thing that, I mean, I guess it's been a while since I was watching videos really trying to learn, you know, what's the difference between a Canon and a Sony? I mean, there was a time when I was researching that stuff, you know, to decide what camera to buy. And obviously, yeah, people would always talk about the Canon autofocus being so good. And I haven't heard as much of that lately, but that could also be because I'm not doing that type of research, so maybe I'm not hearing as much about it, but because it's kind of my impression is it's good, but kind of like the colors, it's, you know, maybe it's good, maybe it's slightly better than others, but I don't feel like it's this huge differentiator.
I think that maybe they're a little behind the curve on a lot of the AI stuff touting.
Like subject tracking, like that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, didn't you like plug a USB stick into your security system to then like improve the AI tracking subject detection?
Sure did.
I mean, it's there. It's out there. And I feel like Canon maybe hasn't been so vocal about that sort of stuff.
They don't have an AI chip in their camera. I mean, why even buy it?
Like, mark my words. Next Canon release, they're going to say the word AI, and it's going to be related to it's going to be like dual pixel AI AF or something.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Dual AI, dual pixel.
Like, the big deal with the dual pixel, we've talked about it before, is, you know, like, they each pixel has an autofocus sight, has a focus sight on it,
yep,
compared to phase detect systems, which just have, they just take a pixel out and put a focus sight in.
Yeah, and then it's like a, they're spread out throughout the sensor.
Mm-hmm, yeah, but you may have like full coverage, but it may be like 500 pixels or something out of mm-hmm. the whole sensor versus Canon, which is every pixel. And so, you know, with all that data, I think it's unique, and I think it is a competitive advantage for Canon. And I think that if they can leverage it with the algorithms, they can probably edge out Sony again, because it's always been like Canon, Sony as far as autofocus.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean that's probably most of the things that I think about for their advantage. I think that
the other thing,
durability and ergonomics are a really big one.
I was going to say that. I mean, I feel like people talk about how comfortable Canon cameras are to hold. And
I have a 7D,
well,
and like, it's legit.
Mm-hmm.
It's very comfortable.
Yeah, same for that. I used to have an EOS R, and I felt the same way about it. I mean, it was a well-designed camera.
I do think they care a lot about what the experience is of using a Canon.
Mm-hmm.
I think it matters a lot to them as far as just people being able to, you know, not feel like they're getting weighed down or hurt by their cameras, and it works with them.
Yeah, well, and I mean, they generally don't try to make their cameras too small either, which is just generally makes it a nicer experience to use it. I mean, I know people like that Sony cameras are really small because they can pack up, you know, into a small bag or whatever. But every time I use a Sony camera, I feel like it's a, you know, kind of like just a block. There's not a whole lot of grip to it, and it's just covered in buttons. I mean, it's like they've made this thing as small as it can possibly be, and they've covered every exposed surface with buttons and controls. And I mean, they're very capable cameras, and they're small, but I can't say they're anywhere near as comfortable to use as something like a Canon.
I think mo buttons, mo better. Okay, there's a few more like little grab bag things here on my list about Canon, and I put them on here and I learned everything about them, and I think I forgot most of what I learned, and so this is actually going to be,
well, this should be interesting.
Really hard to sort out. So there are a few like weird things that Canon's doing as far as sensors and cameras that aren't in like their mirrorless market system.
Okay.
And one of the things is this Canon ME20F SH, and it is a camera, and it has an ISO sensitivity of over 4 million.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is that like for industrial use, or what would you use that for?
Most of the stuff that they show is for like astrophotography, nighttime. They show it as like filming, like create these stunning images or whatever, capture color like never before, but you can shoot at these super insane ISOs, and so you can basically shoot in pitch black and still get like actual color and like renderable footages and images out of it.
Huh.
It's just very, very specific, like super high ISO sensor that they
have. That's weird. It kind of reminds me of those VR lenses they have, you know, where it's like they made this very specific product for a very specific use case. But that's cool.
Yeah, it's cool, right? Like you got color fidelity out of it, and it's just like super duper specific. But and I don't think we're ever going to see an R6 Mark VII that has a high ISO limit of 4 million.
Yeah,
maybe you will, but it's like, Canon is developing these things. I mean, we're always talking about like the super cool dual gain, like high resolution, mm-hmm. whatever, like mirrorless stuff, but they are working on other technologies. So they had this, they came out with this sensor that's really more for like high resolution imaging for special applications, but they have a CMOS sensor that is 250 megapixels, and it's APS-H format, which if I recall is bigger than APS-C, but smaller than full frame.
Huh. That's so it's just like a super high density sensor.
Yeah, exactly. You know, things for like, it's very specific imaging. Think like medical or like meteorology or mapping or that sort of thing, where you just need like really, really high resolution. That's the most important thing.
Pretty cool.
Canon makes a product for that application that you're never going to see in your camera, probably. Yep. But if we're wondering, can Canon make an R1 that has a 100 megapixel sensor, well, they make a smaller sensor than that has 250 megapixels. So like,
interesting.
They have the technology.
Yep.
Okay. And then one more that I want to touch on is like cool thing that Canon's doing, because Canon's making sensors and so is Sony. And like, that's basically it, except for maybe Toshiba. They have this, and this is where it's going to start getting weird. They have this, super high sensitivity SPAD sensor, S-P-A-D.
Single photon avalanche diode.
Yes. And it's like a 3.2 megapixel sensor.
Wow.
And I can't remember why it's super cool. It's like it uses, let me see if I can get this right. Daniel, I'm not going to be able to tell you about SPAD sensors today. I was like, oh yeah, single photon avalanche diode. Yeah, that's different. That's like not a CMOS sensor. It's not a CCD sensor as far as like, oh, we're going to like collect the photons and whatever and like put them in a capacitor and blah, blah, blah and feed it back to the chip. It's like a totally different thing. And I read about it and I was like, this is super, super interesting. And I need to tell Daniel about it in like 6 days.
Yep.
And it's been 6 days.
I think we basically can't give this the Camera Gear podcast treatment.
Yeah. So just go ahead and cut everything about the SPAD sensor out and just know that this is like a new technology and it's like still really low resolution, but it's very interesting as far as its ability to capture light from far away.
Yeah.
I mean, like it has to like travel a distance, right? And like the waves and everything and blah, 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 blah. I just need to stop getting into it.
Maybe we can come back to that in a few weeks and cover it in more detail.
It's super cool. We need to loop back on it, but it's another example of like, here's Canon.
Mm-hmm.
They're working on all these other sensor technologies. And yeah, it's cool to see like, you know, yeah, Sony's making sensors for everything. Like Canon's not just making like camera sensors. They're making camera sensors.
Yeah. I mean, I just like seeing unique stuff like this and, you know, a lot of times things that start out being for industrial imaging or medical imaging or whatever, I mean, that may be a technology that can come down to normal cameras in the future. And so it's cool that they're kind of working in some of these spaces.
Yeah, a lot of innovation seems to happen in like niche areas like
yes.
this.
Yeah.
So like Canon wants to take over the market. They're doing all the R&D to make really cool stuff that we're not necessarily seeing in consumer level cameras yet. And there's still like a lot of lenses and a lot of cameras to come out from them. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that Canon's like the sleeping giant that maybe some of us think about them as.
I mean, they sure seem like they're trying to win.
Yep.
So I guess we'll see what happens. Whatever
that means.
Yeah, whatever that means. Overwhelming market share.
Overwhelming.
That's it for the show today. Thanks for joining us. And if you liked it, tell a friend so they can check it out too. You can find out more about the show at www.cameragearpodcast.com, and you can find us on Twitter @CameraGearPod. We'll be back with more next week.